Good evening and welcome to Pod 37. Double game week off the back of a double game week. Some big results. We're one down this week, so there's three of us. Well, two temporarily. One is feeling a bit part-time today, so he'll be with us shortly. But so for now, for the first part of the show, we've got Cossy. Cossy, how you doing?
Yeah, all good, mate. I think Scott's knocking one off in the background on Valentine's night on his own, isn't he? Yeah, that's why he's not involved.
Yeah, this is very apt. You could have done what I did and done it 20 minutes before the show, but there you go.
Too much information.
Some need longer than others. Some need longer than others. I've always been premature. Anyway. Anyway, so off the back of a double game week, obviously, we had a bit of tense drama this week because we're both down at Carrow Road, so we'll cover that. Obviously, implications, not so much really at the top, let's face it, but certainly at the bottom of the table, it makes for interesting reading, and a couple of surprises in terms of bounces of form as well, so plenty to cover off. We like to save the best till last, so teams like Spurs will wait until the second half of the show because obviously they're on fire and Scott can't wait to talk about the performance that they put in on Sunday, so we'll cover all of that off. And then we'll
even sweeter as he was there as well. Oh, what a trip.
He had a lovely day out, though. If you ask him, he says he had a lovely day out. So it's like being on Bruce Forsyth's Price is Right. Didn't get the prize, but he had a lovely day out. I digress. Let's get straight into it. So, as I said, big talking points up and down the table, and probably more so at the bottom, really. As much as I wanted them to go down, it doesn't look like they are. So we'll start off with Newcastle. So two massive games on paper there. Everton and Villa away and at home respectively. Well, they've won three on the bounce now and two wins, double game week. 3-1 win at Everton. 1-0 win against Villa. They look good. Trippier is having the desired impact. That's two free kicks now. Eddie Howe's gone in. They're doing the job. They needed the results. I think if they didn't get the results, it would have been a bit hairy for them.
From the looks of it, sorry to interrupt, from the looks of it all, you're not the only one that wanted them to go down, obviously. I think you and I, along with 95% of football fans, wanted them to go down because of the hostile atmosphere that always happens at St James's Park under the previous regime and the lack of morals with their new glorious owners. But if any team ever wants a lesson on how to potentially and probably survive from the Premier League, just spend a shitload of money in January, spend 100 plus million, which is obviously small change to their owners, buy from other teams around them, preventing them to kick on from survival. And just pay someone like Chris Wood £100,000 a week not to play for Burnley.
Yeah, no, from what I saw of them pre-Howe, Ryan Fraser didn't really look that great for them. And even when he first, when he first came in, initially he was struggling. But from what I saw very briefly of the Everton game and then also of the Villa game, he looked pretty influential in that lineup.
To be fair, I hold my hands up and say fair play. They're working with the resources that they, are able to do. I think any team would if they could. Like I said, I do like the regime that we do have at Carrow Road. However, it does get criticised. You like the regime at Crystal Palace. I wouldn't necessarily want a billionaire Saudi to come and take us over. Maybe some millennial fans want that. But Newcastle have got who they want. It was a shit ownership in the previous one, but it doesn't wash with me when they say they don't have any money to spend when they've got £40 million Joel Linton and then crying that they haven't got any money to spend whilst paying ASM £83,000 a week. However, they've done what they needed to do. It looks like they're going to be staying up. And to be fair, the win against Everton, that was a good game to watch. And the win, obviously, we'll get onto that later on, but the win at the weekend as well, it was a good game of football. Like, not going to lie, it was good to see a little bit of passion from the supporters. I don't like to admit, but that's a footballing city. And they deserve it. If any other fans deserve a little bit of good fortune, it is them in a way. But yeah, whatever.
It's interesting with Newcastle, isn't it? Because during the January transfer window, up until that last week, even the new infrastructure and owners got a lot of criticism for how they were going about doing business. There was question marks about whether they'd be able to do the business and if they'd done enough. I, for one, was one of them. I thought defensively they'd not done enough. But then, they went in for a late swoop with Dan Burns from Brighton, which on paper is decent because I think every time I've seen him play for Brighton, I've actually thought he's one of their better players. So I was surprised they let him go. But
That's a turn for the books, you praising a Brighton player.
Well, you know, every cloud, there's a first time for everything, isn't there? You know, I'm in the loving mood. It's February the 14th, aren't I? So, you know. But, yeah, I have to admit, I question them at the end of the window as to whether or not they've done enough. But he seemingly has rallied the rest of the troops around him. And you've got St. Maximin making an impact, Ryan Fraser making an impact, Trippier's obviously come in. Big blow for them now because he's out injured and I think he's going to have surgery on his ankle. But, you know, long and short of it is they've won three games on the bounce, two games in a double game week, which, look, if you're getting 6 points from a double game week in a relegation scrap, then, you know, you can't ask for any more than that. And not only that now, they can kind of start to look up because they've got a game in hand on Norwich. They're 4 points clear of the bottom three. So, and, you know, they now find themselves in a position where they're only 3 points off Brentford and 6 points off virtually mid-table, 6 points behind Leicester. So,
got 6 points off Leicester?
Yeah.
What the hell is going on there?
You know, and we've joked about it before and said, well, they've got the money, they've spent money, they'd expect it. But as we always alluded to in previous podcasts, it was always going to be about could Eddie Howe gel them? Have they got the recruitment right? And have they done enough? And so far, it seems to have worked for them. So we'll come on to Everton and Villa specifically later. But I think, you know, Newcastle, I think, unfortunately, as much as I'd love for them to go down, I think that pretty much takes them out of the relegation candidates going forward. You never know. It could change. But they're looking good for it so far. Talking of momentum, so moving on from Newcastle. Interesting one, because they're not really... I mean, I had them down as one of the favourites to go down very, very strongly at the beginning of the season, especially as they ended up selling Vestergaard on deadline day or close to deadline day and didn't replace him and looked pretty threadbare. Southampton.
I love watching them play. There's something about them. James Ward-Prowse, I could just watch him all day. If they had player cam still and it was on James Ward-Prowse, I'd be pressing that red button thinking, do you know what? This guy is—he's so good. But I did a few polls on our Twitter Twitter Football Debate, and obviously, I said how much is he worth, and something like 70% of people said 60 million plus. Now I know, obviously, it could get completely Southampton whitewashed with Southampton fans, but still, it's not really that far off it, really. And if you think, I did another one saying, who would you rather have on your team, Jack Grealish or James Ward-Prowse? And something like, again, 70 to 80%, I think it was 80% said James Ward-Prowse. So Southampton, if they are obviously going to lose him like they do a lot of players, unfortunately for them, they're going to cash in from him. Surely he's superb.
Yeah, no, they will. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what he does at the end of the season. But interesting thing with Southampton is, for me, I thought they were relegation fodder this year. They have been for the last couple of years. And purely from the extent that with Hasenhüttl, when he first came in, they looked like they were trying to play good football, but they didn't quite have the tools. So, and they had, obviously, it's quite well documented, they've been hammered quite a few times. And at one point, it didn't really look like he'd cling on to his job in his first season, especially after that 9-0 defeat.
And I remember TalkSport saying any manager who loses 9-0 surely is going to be shown the door. There must be something about him that gets the players to completely believe in what he does. Can't lose 9-0 and then all of a sudden, you know, win 3-4 in the bounce like they're likely to do sometimes.
Well, the thing that struck me is in that first season when that happened, they didn't really string together any positive results. They kind of bumped along. And then the second season came, and I seem to remember they started off pretty strongly. Then they tailed off and they lost, I think, 9-0 to Leicester. And then you thought, oof. Bloody hell. And then I think they had Man City at the Etihad after that Leicester game. And I think they lost, but they performed pretty well. I can't remember the result, so forgive me if I'm wrong. But again, it looked like he was staring down at the barrel for his job. And then they somehow bumped along and got through to the end of the season. And come this season, they sell Vestergaard. You're looking at their defence and thinking, oof, are they going to manage? And they kind of ebbed and flowed in the beginning, but they seem to be really stringing together some results. And it just seems like now, in that third season, things are starting to click. So where before, it was quite well documented that he played an open style of play, aggressive, high press, very much like Klopp and, you know, Liverpool. But it seems like now, and I think even on the commentary of the game of the weekend, they alluded to it, is that the players seem to know now and have that balance of when to attack. And that, you know, they manage the game better. They, you know, they phase the game out. They know when to control it. They know when to push forward. But equally, they know when to sit back and counter. Because one of the things that impresses me about Southampton is their structure, and that they sit back, and then you get the, you know, the centre backs push the ball up to the wing. You know, Carl Walker-Peters is a key cog in that, pushing the ball up the field. If they can't find room, they'll bring it to Ward-Prowse, and he'll just dictate the play in the middle there. And they'll go off and they'll create something. And Brozier, what a revelation he's been. I mean, workmanlike, young, hungry, strong, pacey, you know, whatever. And arguably for me, one of the signings of the season. I didn't know too much about him beforehand, but I knew
scored the equaliser against Spurs.
Yeah, absolutely. So for them, you look at the results, you know, the Tottenham result, Tottenham win 3-2.
They went 1-0 down and they went 2-1 down. They were 2-1 down with 20 minutes to go. James Ward-Prowse gets two assists to make it 3-2 in the last 10 minutes.
And then you've got the United game where, I mean, look, that's where you could argue Southampton finish a little bit short, is if they were a little bit more clinical, I mean, they could have come away winning that 2-3, you know, 2-3-1.
You're talking about going to Old Trafford and saying Southampton, oh, if they had a little bit more. This is at bloody Old Trafford, man, when they're playing with 80, 90 million pound players from the back to the front. And all of a sudden we're turning around and saying, if Southampton had a little bit more, doesn't that show you how far Southampton has come and how backwards Manchester United have gone as well? Southampton should have had all 3 points, and no one can deny that.
No one. Absolutely.
I don't think Scott would even turn around and say that Tottenham should have come out with that, like the game against Southampton with anything more than 0 points, really, because I know that they control. Like they had it 2-1 with 20 minutes to go, but Southampton always looked like they were going to score. They always looked like they were going to take something from that game. And even though that is a typical sort of Spurs 2, Southampton 2 type game, Southampton came back with all 3 points and they deserved it.
Yeah. And we talk about surprise packages. I mean, a lot of people spoke about Brighton at the beginning of the season for the blistering start they had. But now you see the table kind of evening out and results catching up. Tell you what, past Brighton, Southampton definitely, for me, have to be one, if not the... I mean, Brighton will rightfully get their plaudits, but Southampton, for me, considering they've been relegation fodder, or, you know, near uncertainties for relegation the last two seasons, they've not particularly recruited to... You know, they've brought in Livramento, they've brought in Brozier, young players, good players, both from Chelsea academies, one on a permanent and one on loan. But everyone looked at that squad and said, they haven't done enough defensively. Will they, won't they hang on to Ward-Prowse? Will he keep up his form? You know, but to sit there in 10th is incredible. And, you know, they're now 4 points off Brighton. Granted, there are a couple of one or two games ahead of the rest of the teams, but they're above the likes of Leicester and Villa. And yeah, I mean, it's great for them. And Hasenhüttl has really, really done a job there. And the fact that he's been close to losing his job two or three times and staring at the barrel, managed to turn that round, fair play to them. And Walker-Peters, special mention for him, because we talk a lot about Ward-Prowse and Brozier, but in the last two or three games, Walker-Peters has been really influential to their, especially when they press up from the back and out wide. He's really, really impressed me.
This season especially, he's really pushed on, hasn't he?
He has.
He does look good. He's looking really good.
No, they've done well. And, you know, they do always, I say always, recruit well, but they do buy, you know, young players with potential. Sometimes it can work, sometimes it doesn't, but it certainly seems like. And as I say, the wider point is the system seems to work for them now, you know, with Hasenhüttl, the style of play, the formation. So, yeah. Fair play to them. Very, very good results there. Leaves a lot to ponder for the other two teams, but again, we'll come on to them a little bit later. Now, another team that's been up and down, and well, we actually probably had four top four challenges before the season, is although they've bottled it the last couple of seasons, ultimately finished fifth or sixth, respectively, won the FA Cup last season, not really got going this season, and Liverpool 2-0. If you haven't guessed already, I'm alluding to Leicester.
It's to be expected, but it's just the manner of the results at the minute for Leicester, isn't it?
Yeah.
Again, I did another TFD poll on Twitter, and I said, how many games has Rodgers got? And it was like 2, 3, or 4. And the majority of people said 3 games and then he's gone.
Yeah,
I don't know. I haven't done another one since. And obviously, the most recent result against West Ham, but that felt like a loss to them because obviously at the last minute,
dropped, isn't it?
Exactly. We'll get onto that in a second. But to talk about the Liverpool Leicester game, it was again, like Liverpool didn't necessarily have to get out of second gear to really win that game. To be honest, I think that the second goal obviously killed it, but that could have easily been one goal, and it would have been like, well, yeah, Leicester didn't really show up again.
I mean,
I don't know what's going on there at all. Because I don't know if you saw the tweet. Sorry to carry on, but I don't know if you saw the tweet, but saying Gary Lineker was just talking about, oh yeah, we haven't really got this. We haven't got really, like, haven't really got that. It's thinking, well, look at your owner. Isn't he the top 20 richest men in the world? You've been backed. You know, your players on a hefty wages, and Rodgers has been given the money to spend. And all of a sudden you're thinking, oh yeah, we're not quite so-and-so, or we're not quite so-and-so. It's just like, well, hang on a minute. Have a look. The responses to Gary Lineker, we're just all thinking, like, hang on a minute, mate, you're a bit deluded.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that baffles me about Leicester is that there was a lot of talk at the beginning of the season about their injuries in defence because they didn't have a settled back line. And I've said before, Schmeichel doesn't screen, not now, he maybe did before, but he doesn't screen me as someone that would carry a back line with confidence anyway. Add to that, that they had a chop and change back four for a bit at the beginning of the season, you can understand it. But I'm just looking at the lineup from the game against West Ham. And again, there was a lot of talk about injuries. But, you know, you look at their back line. Justin and Pereira are arguably their first choice left back and right backs. You've then got Soyuncu and Amati as the centre back. Now, Vestergaard was on the bench. So whether that's fitness or not, but, you know, Vestergaard is likely the first choice for Amati, you know, over Amati there. So Soyuncu and... Then you look at the midfield three, you've got Tielemans and Didi and, you know, Dewsbury. Now, Dewsbury's a youngster, of course, he's come through the academy, but he's impressed. He's done a good job. It's not as if he's been awful. But again, you've got options on there. You know, you've got the likes of Maddison on there. You've got Harvey Butt. Like, there's options. And I just, the injury thing can only carry you so much. And as you say, they've got owners that have got money. You know, up front, you've got, I mean, sorry, Maddison actually started that game. I apologise, he wasn't on the bench. But, you know, they've got the likes of Iosi Perez, who I think they spent 27 million on to kind of fill a midfield position. You know, Adam Olukman, Chowdhury, who was highly rated 2 or 3 seasons ago, and he seems to have gone by the bye as well. So for me, that injury argument can only carry you so far. And it seems like that's what's been hanging for them all season.
What Leicester mean is when they've got injury problems, basically, Jamie Vardy's injured.
Yeah, but then I'd argue they've got Daka, who...
I agree with you. What I'm saying is their argument is that, oh, we've got injuries. And it's just like, well, just because your main man, Jamie Vardy, who, let's be honest, unfortunately, is getting a little bit past it, you need to look a bit more for the future. You need to look past Jamie Vardy's injury because he's not the future for Leicester. And though he's completely integral to how you play, why have you not got a backup that does exactly the same as what Jamie Vardy does? Yes, it takes investment, but you've got other players... You know, like you say about Daka, why can't he do the Jamie Vardy role?
And, you know, the other thing as well, it's not, you know, the West Ham game, again, last-minute equaliser, which will, it will kill them. It will kill their confidence. So, I mean, we've spoke a lot about it a lot, and it came to the fore with Sky Sports. I think they were talking about it after the game, and they were talking about this idea of transition and project and Leicester having to rebuild. But they were talking about the size of that task and the potential money involved and what that means for Leicester. Obviously, the news has come out this week that Tielemans isn't going to renew. So, you know, he's obviously going to be a goner in the summer.
And that, to me, caused a bit of like animosity between the players. Like when he scored his penalty, it took a few seconds for players to really start celebrating with him. You think, well, do you really blame him?
I mean, Brendan Rodgers... I liken him to Alan Pardew. I always feel like he has the instant impact as soon as he joins a club. You ride that wave, you hit a peak. Obviously, they won the FA Cup. But now they're at the point where they're, you know, they've kind of gone down again. And he doesn't seem to have got them out of that blip. But if you're Leicester and you're the owners, what is your answer going into the end? Well, obviously, who knows if he'll be sacked before the end of the season, but because they don't really have a lot to play for. But if you're the Leicester owners now, you've got the headache of a potential manager replacement in the summer, but let's face it, that is a big transitional job. Whoever come, you know, if Rodgers is replaced, that is a big job on their hands. Like, granted, they've got good players, but Tielemans will be gone. James Maddison, it wouldn't surprise me if the talk starts with him again, because I think he'll look at someone like Tielemans leaving and think, maybe not, maybe so, I don't know.
Well, maybe they've sort of peaked. At the end of the day, what they achieved, obviously, in 2016 was absolutely incredible. And though we are Slayton, they did win the FA Cup last season, which fair play to them. However, we're now looking at them like they're up there with the big boys. And there's two seasons in a row they've bottled the top four when it was completely in their hands, when it was completely up to them. And I know we're talking about them as if they should be getting to the top four like a Manchester United type team. However, at the end of the day, it is only Leicester City. I think everyone in the world, like everyone in the English league, loved that they won the Premier League. However, maybe they were just a small team punching with the big boys and they can't really hack it.
If they missed their opportunity, and if they were to rebuild, and if whether it's Rodgers or someone else, are they capable of getting the... I mean, look, you know, they've still got someone like Fofana and Castagna out injured. Are they in a position where if they did rebuild that they're capable of recruiting those players? Or are they in danger of being left behind by the likes of West Ham, Wolves? Quite a big impact on their future. You're in competition for players again because they don't have Europe to fall back on. They're not going to win honours again. They're not going to be, you know, they're in Europa League this season. So the last two seasons have been in Europa League. This season it's mid-table. So really for them, it's really a restart and go, because what they need to be looking at, if the owner's aspiration is still be up there, is to get back into Europe. And I'll be honest, with the likes of West Ham, I can't believe that Man United would be as bad. I mean, we say this every season for the past four or five seasons, but I don't believe Man United will be that bad again next season. The rumours are true they'll get Pochettino. And then you've got the likes of Arsenal, and, you know, who knows with them. But it's an interesting one with Leicester. Just one where they can't quite seem to get it right and they're stuck. I can't see them getting out of it. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the summer, bigger picture, but I think they're gonna struggle with that one. I'm gonna jump straight into the team that's seemingly replaced them in that top four kind of contender, you know, challenging the big quartet, if you like. West Ham, however, again, down to them at the beginning of the season, whether they'll be able to upkeep with the Europa League and everything else. But 1-0 win against Watford, typical dragged out hard work and result against a typical Hodgson team there. And that last gasp equaliser against Leicester. Now, headlines around West Ham for different reasons, which we won't go too much into because we all...
The thing is, it's a major distraction, isn't it? Now we've got Karen Brady coming out and saying, can we just move on now? And it's just like, well, yeah. No. And then all of a sudden, their bloody fans are kicking a fucking inflatable cat around singing pro-Zuma songs. And it's just like, for goodness sake, what, like, this is what frustrates the hell out of me for football fans, because people who don't like football, or, you know, they read the press and all of a sudden it's just like, oh, here we go again. And it is, even as a football fan myself who absolutely loves the game, I've got my head in my hands thinking, here we fucking go again. It's just like, can we not just have some sort of something between our ears, for goodness sake?
I mean, look, Graeme Souness, oh, yes. Very old school one. But look, he didn't pussyfoot around the situation, no pun intended.
For fuck's sake.
But, you know, it's the thing that baffles me, and I'm not going to say too much on it because, you know, it's been around in circles in the media and stuff. But the thing that baffles me about football is that there seems to be this line of, oh, pardon me, forgive us, we're only human, it was a mistake. And Souness is right, you know. It's the guy doesn't seemingly on the face of it, and as Souness rightly pointed out, the statements that West Ham have put out is PR. It's PR. It's structured because they have to do it. They have to make these statements. But footballers seem, West Ham and, you know, football clubs seem to deem footballers, because they're these high-end commodities of theirs, that they need to be afforded. You know, if that was me or you, we'd be arrested and charged accordingly. Now, as soon as it rightly pointed out, it's one thing doing it, it's two things getting caught, but it's the third thing doing those first two, and then thirdly thinking it's okay to put it on social media.
And doing it in front of the kids as well.
But it's also a fourth thing, then acknowledging that you think you're funny because it was uploaded with, some laughing emojis. It's very hard, as you say, if you're someone that doesn't like football and likes to complain to football fans about footballers, that example gives a lot of ammunition. And I think one of the things that isn't spoken about enough in that situation is what was rightly pointed out by Laura Woods, is that this isn't just about someone abusing a cat or animal abuse. This is about someone who is a figurehead in everyday popular culture, football. And this is something that kids will pick up and look at and think, ha, that was funny. Let me give that a go. And I think that's a bit that's missing. And David Moyes talks about forgiveness and this, that, and the other. But yeah, okay, to a point. But the punishment should still, and the ramifications need to be, and I don't think the bigger picture has been, I don't think the club has, I mean, I don't think the club have covered themselves in glory because they've just popped out a couple of generic PR lines. And I mean, finance-wise, okay, I get it. They've legally done the most they can do financially within their means. That's absolutely fine. But David Moyes could have taken a stance and said, right, lad, you're out of the team for 10 games or rest. He could have done that. He could have done that. And it's one of those things, this whole debate about business versus ethics and where you are. And quite clearly for West Ham and David Moyes, it was business over the ethics. And that for me is, I'm not a West Ham fan, but that to me is alarming when you start putting that, you take other situations that have happened to other footballers into play. And if they did the same thing, it sets a bit of a precedent to me as to, oh, don't worry, lad. You've still got your job where you're paid really handsomely. Come and play some football. Come and do your. It doesn't send out the right message.
Thank you, pretty that one.
Still in fourth place. A point ahead of United. United obviously have a game in hand. The likes of Arsenal, this is where it really gets interesting. Obviously, now it's getting a bit tight there because between, well, if you go far as down as Tottenham, there's 5 points between Spurs in eighth and West Ham in fourth. So West Ham have done well, I think, with the squad they've got. They haven't suffered as much as I thought they would with kind of squad management and Europa League and Premier League. Whether or not now, I mean, the likes of Arsenal could have a massive impact on West Ham's, where they finish because they've got three games in hand. Spurs have also got three games in hand. So those two still have a say, which is quite ironic. But one of them will end up having a runners-up DVD and the other one will end up having a DVD to celebrate finishing fourth. But they're still in the mix and keep themselves within it. Been a little bit more inconsistent, and it'll be interesting to see now with all the kind of PR that's all gone on, how much of a distraction that is. But key players keep doing it. Bowen, again, I mean, run out of plaudits to say about him. He's spoken about every week now, but since he's come into that team and joined them from Hull, he's been one of the most consistent players. And dare I say it, probably putting himself in for a great shout for the World Cup as well, I think.
He's going to go to the World Cup. He's got to.
Then on to Everton. Taylor, two halves, really. One bad result, one good result. Where are they going to end up with Lampard?
They're a flip of a coin, aren't they? It seems like they're all or nothing. Against Newcastle, they were absolutely nothing. And it was quite reassuring to see. You thought, oh, as a Norwich fan, you think, oh, here we go. Even the big boys, Everton, could get called into this relegation. I think if you ask any Premier League fan who they want to get into a relegation scrap, they want Leeds to be dragged into it, really. But again, we're eating our words when it comes to the second game at Goodison Park. It's madness. I don't really know what to say about them. You could literally write headlines every 5 minutes in watching Everton. And then if you're going to talk about the latest game, they were absolutely incredible. It's madness, absolute madness.
Yeah, it really was a kind of mixed bag. I mean, that Newcastle result on paper was an absolute disaster for them. And the pressure going into that game against Leeds was absolutely massive. I didn't see that coming, to be honest. And I fear, after that Newcastle result, I really did fear the worst for them, which I think is what you get with Lampard. He's one of those risk and reward managers. Same with many of the kind of managers seemingly going through that transition phase. The way he plays, you're either going to get spanked or you'll win comfortably and or somewhere in between. It would have been fun to see them in a relegation fight, but I do ultimately think they'll just about have enough quality to kind of...
It seems like every single week we're made to look silly by them. Yeah. It's just like, okay, told you so. And then all of a sudden it's just like, yeah, you knocked yourself off there, which is very difficult to talk about Everton at the minute.
I think the key for them will be, as I said, I don't think they'll go down because as we alluded to at the beginning, there is a bit of a gap now opening up at the bottom and they've got the players to get them out of it. But I think the key for them in the kind of long term as well was going to be finding the right balance and getting the right, you know, they signed Van der Beek and Dele Alli, two very similar players. Granted, Van der Beek will go back to United or, you know, across Europe at the end of the season. But I think for Lampard, the key challenge is going to be finding the right system for the right players and working out who's key and who isn't. And I think he's afforded himself a bit of breathing space now, unfortunately, to give him that time to do that. So, as you say, mixed bag, and we'll talk about the Leeds game from a Leeds perspective in the second segment. But from an Everton perspective, I think, well...
The Newcastle result's forgotten about.
Well, I was going to say, I think Lampard, for his sake, probably needed that as well. So
massively. Because it went from, you know, fans cheering his name to like thinking on against Newcastle away, thinking, what the hell have we got here?
I mean, the defensive side of it against Newcastle, that would have been the worrying thing for me after that game. When you're in a relegation fight, the most you want to see is 100% effort and a bit of defensive discipline. And they just seemed a bit all over the place. And, you know, granted, he's only been there a couple of games, so it will take time. It did look a bit concerning. But as you say, on the flip side, comfortable win against Leeds. And I think Everton fans will just about be happy with that, all things considered. On to Palace, more familiar territory for me. Bit of an underwhelming week for us, I'm not going to lie. I said the Norwich game was pretty big for us and also, well, the next two games, because it could be the difference between being suckered in to a relegation battle or not. I think in hindsight, now I know what I know from after the Brentford game and the Man City-Norwich game in the evening. Not that, you know, Norwich are out of it by any means, but that points gap now is probably too much for them to maybe put the likes of Palace under pressure. But look, one thing that concerned me in the Norwich game, which was put to bed a little bit against Brentford, was our start. We were so slow out of the blocks.
39 seconds, was it?
Yeah, I mean, it was unbelievable. And it's interesting with Palace because often we get caught out with kind of slumber starts. And then in the second half, like against Norwich, and against Brentford, we came out blistering. It's like, what does Vieira say at half-time that doesn't rein in the first half? It's a bit of an odd situation because we're quite a progressive team and we play quite well throughout games, and both Norwich and Brentford, we dominate possession. Norwich, it was evident we weren't aggressive enough or forward enough in that in the middle of the park.
The thing is, I think that game, the game at Carrow Road, I'll be completely brutally honest with it, if we had scored a second goal, if Pukki would have taken his chances, I think we would have won that 2-0, 2-1 and thought, you know, here we go. However, we had you in the first half, you battered us in the second half. I think overall a 1-1 draw was fair. However, as a Norwich fan, after giving away a penalty, it was just like, thank fuck we didn't lose that.
Look, the Norwich game, we were unlucky. That penalty, I don't know if you noticed, it got a lot of media attention, that penalty miss. Baffled me slightly because, you know, we've all seen players slip and miss penalties. And at first I was fuming, but actually when you look it back, it's one of those unfortunate situations where he loses his balance on his holding foot and it gives way.
I think he's had unfair criticism, to be honest, for that. I mean,
there was a whole article published by, I think it was The Telegraph, that basically was like, oh my God, it was the worst penalty ever. And a whole kind of analysis about how he missed. And I was thinking, well, John Terry in Moscow against United.
Yeah.
You know, Jason Puncheon against Spurs at White Hart Lane. I mean, there are many examples of players that have missed penalties.
And if you want to talk about one of the worst penalties, it was Thierry Henry and Pires back in the day as well, when he tried to lay it off. That was intentional. Whereas what Saha did was completely unintentional. I felt sorry for them.
Yeah.
So, I'm glad it happened, don't get me wrong, but I felt sorry for him. There's been a couple of times where you've seen someone slip in the penalty and kick it twice, and you know, there's been given an indirect free kick or whatever. But it's I think considering he scored an absolute belter 5 minutes before that, or like a minute before that, or whatever it was. But sitting where I sat, I just thought, oh, here we go. They've scored a belter of an equaliser. You've got to hold your hands up. And all of a sudden, we give away a penalty. Max Aarons has been caught out a few times recently. And all of a sudden, it's just like, oh, here we go. But yeah, thank the Lord for that slip.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, as you say, scored a rocket. Brentford game, disappointing. We dominated that one. Should have, you know, we were lucky. In gear, nearly gave away a penalty. You know, we did threaten that, but again, it was all possession-led and there wasn't really much in the final third that we, that we came up with. So it was disappointing in that regard. Big games coming up for us. Now we've got Chelsea at home on Saturday, then another home game against Burnley the following week. So it does give us chance to, you know, as I said, I don't think we're going to be sucked into the relegation battle because as long as you draw these games, you're all right. But we need to find that cutting edge. We lacked a bit of cut and thrust in that final third, I think. And that's disappointing considering we're, you know, full strength. You know, Zaha, Elise, Benteke, Mateta, you know, there's various options there. Not that I'm saying they played badly, because against Norwich, especially in the second half, they did look good. But there was just, as you're well aware, in that Norwich game, the minute Zaha missed that penalty, the game just kind of petered out. There wasn't really anything that happened. And you know, same for the Brentford game. Lack of cutting edge cost us on that one. And that's all I've got to say on that, really. The sooner they can get some wins under the belt, the better. Moving on, another team rooted to the bottom, but with many games in hand. So they'll be playing probably three times a week up until April or May. Burnley, with maybe reasons to be cheerful here. Obviously lost on Sunday against Liverpool 1-0, as you'd expect. But, you know, only by the odd goal. So they should be encouraged by that. And then a well-deserved point against Manchester United out of the blue.
What can you say? Is anyone surprised at that result anymore?
No, I mean, typical Dyche performance. As I say, again, for them, it's going to be a case of, they're still rooted at the bottom. Newcastle winning, they're two games in hand. You know, they're 7 points off, so still a tall order. But, you know, if you can grab points here and there against, like, you know, the likes of United, the key for them is going to, you know, the two key players now, Cornet and Vaghurst, they're going to be the key players now for them. Whether or not they can do enough remains to be seen. But as I say, you can't, those two fixtures on paper look absolute nightmare fixtures. So to come out with a point, well, let's roll straight into Man United because they're next on the hit list and it makes sense from that Burnley game. So 1-1 against Burnley and a hard 4 point, which arguably they didn't deserve, against Southampton. So 2 points from a possible sixth, added to that an FA Cup exit the week before. I mean, we say it every week for them, but it's not looking good, is it? It's really
when Fabinho, holding defensive midfielder for Liverpool, has scored 5 goals since January and Cristiano Ronaldo has scored 0. It says a lot about their star man and a lot about how Liverpool are performing compared with them at the moment. And again, long may it continue. But again, what Gary Neville turned around and said the other day, saying that there's been players leaking tactics, formations, starting 11s, etc. to the press. And he said to the camera, I know exactly who you are.
There's massive problems at that club. And it's not just on the field. It's, you know, it's the infrastructure. It's, you know, behind the scenes. And I think even if Pochettino, even if the speculation is true and they get hold of him, will it be the same outcome as now? Probably, unless he can fix what the issues are in the back room and get what he wants. And
hope is the former.
Exactly. The longer it goes on, the better. But at some point, they are going to have to get it right because they're in danger of being left behind, as we say every year. And, you know, we spoke about Ronaldo before. As you say, he's not scored yet for them this side of the year. A lot of fanfare when he arrived, taking them up to the next level. And it just doesn't seem to be happening, does it? So, same old story for them. And we say the same every week. So the less said, the better. Now, another surprise one, who's been really inconsistent, but seemed to have strung together a couple of results. Wolverhampton Wanderers are up there again. Unlucky arguably to lose against Arsenal. And then, well, I'm not going to say too much on the latter game because we'll leave that for our resident Spurs fan to cover off. But from a Wolves perspective for the Spurs game, cracking result, two quick goals, brilliant result off the back of that.
As soon as Wolves scored, that was going to be their game for me. Because they rarely concede. However, you know, like as I always say, I judge a team when Norwich have beaten them and got points from them this season, and I've not really seen much from them in person. We're obviously watching them live. It does surprise me a little bit. However, knowing that they're beatable, the result at White Hart Lane is incredible for them. But they score first, they win, basically. And that probably goes against 90% of teams they'll play in the Premier League, even the top teams.
Mm-hmm. No, and again, it's that old adage, the control of midfield, you know, although they're inconsistent, but they seem to be striking up a bit of form. You know, they've got key players in there, Neves, Dodonka, who obviously ended up scoring. So, you know, they're able to control the game. And as you say, 9 times out of 10, if they control the game, then they see it out. And certainly wasn't the case kind of pre, and remember early in the season, Wolves were struggling a little bit because they couldn't score, couldn't quite get the results over the line. But Scott was always a big advocate, and I always said, you know, about the manager and the way he plays football, eventually it would come good. And, you know, they've gone into that game, no Neto, no Moutinho, and they've got, not just a result, but a very, very decent result against a... Well, we all thought it could be a bit of a resurgent Spurs, even though they lost to Southampton. But we'll come on to them in the latter part of the segment. And for the final side of this segment, Aston Villa, who, I mean, I think they'll be disappointed, to be honest, with the outcome of their games, very much on the upward trajectory since Stevie G came in.
Well, it's certainly not boring watching them, is it?
No, well, I mean, it's a thriller to begin with.
Yeah.
All pre-deceded out, which I must admit, I had them down to maybe winning at St James's Park.
Yeah, I did. I think I predicted that they were going to win. And the game against Leeds, they went 1-0 down. They were winning, 3-1 at one point. You'd have thought, come on, see the game out, especially with Stevie G in charge. You'd have thought, well-oiled machine, confidence sky high. Coutinho with a couple of assists, but Coutinho's done his work. Why didn't he come off? Why did he play the full 78th minute? He was still on the pitch. You think, well, take a luxury player like that off when you're 3-1 up, even if it's 10 minutes into the second half, not with 10 minutes to go.
To come away and not score against
Newcastle. Such a strange result.
I mean, one thing I will say with that Newcastle game is it made it very, very interesting with VAR and when they disallowed Villa's goal.
Oh, come on. If you waited that bloody long for
Let, let's be honest.
God's let, sake, let's be honest. It's just boring, isn't it? I think it's one of my friends said, as soon as you are drawing lines to find out if someone is offside or not, then just give the bloody goal.
Steven Gerrard, I mean, let's get on to him because, you know, they've done very well since he's come in, not had a lot to complain about. Good style of football, settled in pretty well, seemed to have got the best out of the starting 11. But pretty critical of his team. He wasn't happy with the performance, was he? And said about, you know, having to go over what players didn't do and that it wasn't up to the expected standard. So, you know, as I say, he's not going to get them into Europe or anything, but he's clearly got a very, very set way that he wants to play and a set standard. 6 points off ninth. As I say, they've been going great guns since he came in. And yeah, as I say, I found it very interesting that he really wasn't happy with the standard of the performance. And I think his line was that maybe one of them or two or three of the players can really hold their head up high and say they'd done what they were supposed to do. But other than that, they're going to finish the season probably mid-table, not really much to complain about. But I can see off the back of conceding 3 goals against Leeds, to then go to Newcastle and concede one and not reply is a little bit kind of flat foot. And it has to be said as well, it didn't quite click for them on the offensive side of it against Newcastle, I don't think. And, you know, Newcastle, I felt like, didn't really have to kind of work too hard to get the result in the end, certainly to dig the result out anyway. It wasn't kind of backs to the wall type job.
Agreed.
One thing that struck me about Villa, actually, so there's two things. And again, maybe links to early in the season with all these attacking players. Danny Ings off the boil, completely off the boil. The second thing off the boil is Luca Digne. Now, for Everton, very consistent with his set piece deliveries and stuff, big money signing, but every cross he put in, every set piece, every corner, didn't get past the first man. And if I'm Stephen Jett, I'd be very disappointed. That was, you know, £28 million signing. Bigger picture for Villa, probably doesn't have too much of an impact their season, but that old question mark about players and fitting into systems and stuff, the kind of form of Danny Ings will be one for concern, no matter which way you look at it, is another big money signing. So, but as I say, other than that, safe as houses. So, you know, a point out of a possible six, probably not Gerrard's finest hour, but, you know, given the context of the job he's done there so far, I think Villa fans will be pretty happy. And that wraps us up for segment one. And just like that, our North London resident Spurs fan should be back with us. Better late than never.
I just every now and again, I just drop in. I've been cool observing, as I said.
I'm surprised it took you that long to give a good seeing to you for Valentine's night before you could join the boys.
Yeah, funny. So where are we at? We're at the middle segment then, are we?
We are indeed. Welcome.
Cool. I'm going to have to blitz through this one for you then, because it was a double game week of predictions. Not many green ticks that I can see here, unfortunately. So let's go. Newcastle, Everton. Only one person got a point here. That would be Cossy. He was the only one that said that Newcastle would beat Everton, which puts him into the 30-point mark. You've gone up to 30 points now, Cossy. Not far behind at all. Villa Leeds, I don't think anyone saw that coming, hence why none of us got a point. Norwich Palace, three people said it would be a draw. Jason, you thought there'd be goals, it looks like, mate, because you got a point, but you said it'd be 2-2. Myself and Cossy, however, we said it would be 1-1. So, Cossy, you are hitting a bit of form here, mate. You're on 33 points now. Jason, you're on 35. You go up one tied with Cookie. I'm on 45, so not bad going. Wolves, Arsenal. None of us thought Arsenal would win. Not even Cookie. That's embarrassing. Man United, Southampton. Cookie got 3 points there. He said it would be 1-1, so he goes up to 38. The only other person that got a point in that game was myself. I said it would be 2-2. I gave Man United far too much credit there, thinking they'd get more than one goal, as if that ever happens these days. Watford, Brighton. Guess who got another point, Cossy? You're boring me, mate. You go on to 34 points.
How many games have I missed, though?
I know, you're doing all right. You said it would be 2-1 Brighton. Only a goal out, not too bad. Newcastle Villa, as Jason just said, I don't think anyone saw. Mind you, Jace, just to rub salt in the wounds, it was 3-1 Villa at one point, which is what you had. So that's annoying. But yeah, none of us had a draw. And then final scoreline, you know, not to take this away from you again, Jace, you said 2-1 Leicester, and West Ham decided to equalise, which gives Cossy, of course, 3 points. So, you know that person that was arrested for match fixing? I'm starting to wonder if we've got him on our show, to be honest, because that officially puts Cossy, bearing in mind he was how many weeks behind, Jace? That officially puts him above you. So Cossy,
broadband bill, and he's sitting there so smug. Look at that.
Cossy now goes above Jason on points. I never thought it'd be possible. I mean, anyone would think that Norwich had got a chance of staying up if that's what could happen. But I won't go there. That's predictions done. Double game week out the way. Hopefully, there's not many more of them. And can I go now? Because I don't need to hang around for this second segment, do I?
No. I thought you were going to kick this off quite nicely.
For what? Watford, Leeds, Brentford, Liverpool, Man City, Norwich. I mean, Arsenal, Wolves, Brighton, we can talk about Chelsea winning the Club World Cup if you want. I don't mind.
Well, I mean, the Wolves game, Lane was quite interesting, wasn't it?
It's not called White Hart Lane anymore. So
your big day out, that one, the one you went to.
Fuck. Well, all right. Yeah, I mean, we've had a bad game. We've had a bad 10 days or whatever it is. I was hoping you cleared that in the first segment, seeing as it would have been, I'm sure, at the tip of your tongue. But of course, you would have saved it for me. So thanks, boys. Appreciate it. Yes, I made a 2-hour, 20-minute journey down to North London yesterday, only to go and watch my team mauled by a pack of wolves. Livid. I don't know what was worse, watching a Palace Norwich game or Tottenham losing to Wolves. It wasn't a very good atmosphere in all seriousness. Not because it wasn't an atmosphere. It just got a little bit hostile down there. I thought they'd be ready for a kick up the arse after that Southampton result. At least with Southampton, I can sit back and go, do you know what? Southampton absolutely wiped the floor with us and deserved those 3 points. Wolves did what Wolves do. We said, if they get a goal, that's probably it. And they got a goal within 6 minutes. So to know from 6 minutes onwards the game was over was an issue. And then to go and make it two, yeah, you're not coming back from that. Wolves don't concede many goals, and yesterday was a perfect example as to why. Yeah, a lot to think about for Conte. But once again, the same old players are at the tip of my tongue and on the end of my insults. You know, it's like a script week in, week out.
Did you see the analysis from Match of the Day, Ronnie Jones?
I didn't. To be honest, I say this, and this is the problem with YouTube and things like that now. Obviously, it's convenient to catch the highlights as they come online. So Match of the Day is kind of a long time to wait until I see a game. And I'm not going to lie, I don't often watch Match of the Day if Spurs haven't won. But I did hear the analysis was quite scathing.
The thing is, was it scathing, but they obviously showed it. And it's unbelievable that a Conte team can be that lackluster in possession, that clumsy, that panicky, that lack of composure, et cetera, et cetera. And it was just like thinking, well, you don't necessarily notice that as much when you're watching it. However, when they break it down and you watch it, you're just thinking, what the hell are they playing at?
It was so interesting to see. You know, we had great seats. We were literally, I mean, you could touch the pitch almost. We were like 9 rows from the front. So it felt very sort of on top of it all. And it was striking to see the difference in quality between certain individuals. You know, you had Romero at the back, who was basically trying to piggyback those two centre-halves either side of him. You've got Bentancur, who in the middle must be looking at the guy to his right in, you know, winks by name, wank by nature, wondering what on earth he's doing there. And then you've got Son and Kane up top. And I mean, Kane had a good game, which, you know, is promising because at least he's showing he wants it. But my God, I mean, you talk about this kind of Boreham Wood going up against Bournemouth. That is the equivalent of the talent in that Spurs team. You've got players that are up there, and then you've got, unfortunately, a calibre of conference, you know, national league player type in some of those, such as Sanchez and Winks.
Sanchez looked particularly poor, completely out of his depth. Like I said, there's lack of composure and just the sheer panic whenever the ball went anywhere near him.
Yeah, and I think Conte's right. You know, his post-game analysis was pretty friendly for Conte, considering the manner of the performance. But he's not wrong in saying, you know, the expectations, and he said this about the board and the fans, our expectations are far too high and we've made our own bed. At the end of the day, we need to be realistic and sit back and go, we are years away from getting to the expectations that we feel are a given for Spurs. Because at the moment, I can't honestly see. I know we've got 2 games in hand over United and we could be above them, but with the players we've got there, I just can't see us turning around certain games. And, you know, we've got Man City next. That's one of those games in hand gone. So I think we just need to be realistic and hope he sticks around and the board back him.
Revel in the tears.
I think Cookie would be licking those tears right now, wouldn't he?
Talking of which, your old neighbours, Arsenal, only involved in one game, but you'd think with the amount of headlines they generated, it was about 2 or 3 games. And the biggest talking point, I mean, first of all, kudos to them, grinded out a result. 1-0, hard-fought win, traditional 1-0 to the Arsenal. So, tick, they got the 3 points. But the big talking point that I'm intrigued in both of your opinions on, because it was the big talking point, Martinelli, Crimea River, was the referee correct in showing the two yellow cards? And in no particular order, just because he's probably a bit bitter from Sunday and probably got a bit to say about it. Scott, your thoughts?
I think if you can't identify the fact, I mean, unless there's a rule on paper that states the referee has to show the card, if you can't identify that you may have just put your hand in someone's face to stop a throw-in and then you knock someone down and that might be potentially two yellow cards, then I wonder if these football players need to go to school in midweek before they play their game at weekend, because it's just a lack of intelligence. I'm sorry.
Footballers get a bad rep for not being the sharpest tools in the box, but come on. The fact that Twitter is still trying to back him up and you get like Martin Keogh and talk about how are you supposed to know that you would have a yellow card?
Hey, you guys!
It's just like, seriously, get over yourself.
Well, I'm glad we're all in agreement, but yeah, you're right. I think, look, if he doesn't know a yellow card's coming his way after shoving his hands to his chest and face, we all know what happens once you raise your hands. To cry dumb to that and be like, and for Martin Keown to be like, well, it's unprofessional, the referee, because he doesn't know he's going to get booked. I'm sorry, but you know, if you're going to raise your hand at chest or face level to a player, you're going to get booked. And I've seen a lot of debate of, oh, well, it was the same phase of play. Well, technically not, because the first one happened when the ball was out of play and the second one happened at a new phase of play when he chucked the ball back into play and they were live again. So
anybody arguing it is just completely clutching at straws. Cookie held his hand up and said, what the hell is Martinelli doing? And Cookie is absolutely spot on. It's reassuring to hear an Arsenal fan turn around and say that, because I had a couple of, not arguments as such, but, you know, people on Twitter saying, well, how are you supposed to know? And it's just like, well, it's quite clear that you're on a yellow card when you shove someone in the face and then all of a sudden just hack someone down. It's completely clumsy. It's completely stupid. Like I said, it doesn't give footballers intelligence, reputation. It doesn't do that any favours whatsoever.
No. And I think, I mean, look, they got the result as well at the end of the day. So I don't understand why they struggled so much to get their heads around it. But there we go. Anyway, moving on swiftly, enough about North London, because they're a bit boring nowadays, aren't they? Let's go somewhere a bit more exciting than North London. Let's go down to Hertfordshire, where Roy Hodgson is now back in charge at Watford. And, well, it's not really gone to plan for them, is it? Really not.
Oh, yeah, Roy is sure up that back line when he's
there. I mean, interestingly, he's come out after the weekend and said, well, if these players are good, I'm not really seeing it at the moment. He's gone in on them a little bit. I don't know if you've seen the piece on The Athletic, but it seems pretty early to be low-key laying into your players.
That's okay. He'll be sacked in about 3 games' time anyway.
You know what? I mean, they lost to West Ham 1-0, put up a hard-fought performance, lost to Brighton 2-0. So on paper, they were tough fixtures anyway. But I feel sorry for Watford fans, because outside of the fact they're in a relegation fight, I can't think of a club in the Premier, and I could be wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, I can't think of a club in the Premier League right now that is lacking in such an identity. And this isn't just now, but the last couple of seasons, but lack of identity and lack of identity and link and connection to the supporters. And if you look at Watford fans on Twitter and social media, a lot of them sound like and talk about how they've become disillusioned with the club. There's no connection. There's no connection between fans and players. There's no connection between fans and ownership. The players are all individual. And when I talk about connection, is you look at every club in the Premier League and there's a style of football, there's an identity. I think I've spoken about this briefly when we've mentioned Watford in the kind of beginning of the season, but you don't look at Watford and say, right, who's their talisman? What's their style of play? Who's their go-to? Who's the fan favourite? You know, Troy Deeney, love him or hate him, he was a good player to have around that football club because he got it. And he was the connection between the fans. The owners aren't very vocal. The managers are like you know, they just come and go and churn. And the players, I mean, you look at them, you say, oh, yeah, you know, Ismaïla Sarr is their talisman or Dennis is their talisman. But are they really? And then you start thinking, well, what's their style of play? And you've brought in someone like Hodgson. Well, clearly the style of play isn't known because they've not really brought someone in that's optimised to get the best out of attacking players. So it's an interesting one, but it's a tough one for them. And, you know, when you're in that position, you need the 12th man. And at the moment, I don't think they're not even getting that, are they? And obviously, I mean, look, Hodgson didn't have the desired impact at Palace for 7 or 8 games. So, but, you know, I think for Watford, it's arguably probably too late. And I think this was maybe a get-out-of-jail-free card. If it works, great. If it doesn't, on paper, we went for the right guy. But it was, you know, a case of too little, too late. And, of course, the big concern will be, if you believe the numbers in terms of the debt they're supposedly in, are they going to be one of those teams that come back up? Or will they just kind of fade into the background and into the Championship for a few years?
Like I said, last time they were in the Championship, they kept hold of a £30 million player and played a £30 million player in the Championship to get promoted, which who can say that they can do that other than maybe a team like Fulham? Didn't one of their owners have like a big bust up with a fan during one of the games as well? It's only about 5 or 6 games ago. Do you remember seeing that?
No, I don't remember.
It got really animated around the sort of director's box where he was, and he was like, you know, sort of in someone's face, and you think, well, it's not very, you know, like, yeah, this is fair enough. Like, you know, Dylan might get pissed up and like, you know, start shouting at Norwich fans through a microphone after a few wines, but at least he's not trying to fucking headbutt the people paying wages, you know, the club's wages to go and see the team. It's mental. It's a bit, as you say, where's Watford's identity? Yeah. It's a shame that the fans have literally no connection whatsoever to the regime, the players, anything at the football club. Because that's what's a big thing for me and a big thing for you, that you want to feel a bit of connection. That's where you allude to the owners. And yeah, though, might be a bit of a laughing stock ever so often. I know 100% what club I'd rather be involved in.
And the thing is, in this situation, when you're down where Watford are, you really do need that 12th man. You need your fans on side, and you know the owners haven't really done anything to give their fans any sort of hope, really. So, writing's on the wall, it looks like, for Watford on that one. Moving on. Pantomime villain or not, he mixes opinions, and you know media seem to love them, and you know at times, well, they really have come into their own the last few games. Leeds, of course, you'd expect goals on both sides for them because look, that's the type of team they are. And lo and behold, here we are speaking about that, and in 2 games they've conceded 6, drew 3-3 to Villa, lost 3-0 to Everton. For me, that's Bielsa ball in a nutshell, and that is why I do not get the fuss about how good he is.
Surprised in a way, because Leeds looked like they were starting to hit a bit of form. Surprised that Rafinha came off at half-time against Everton, because he seemed like the only player to be threatening Everton in the final third. Good result against Villa after going 3-1 down. So you can give him a little bit of credit in that game. However, overall, the result against Everton just baffles me, to be honest, because Everton, for me, after the shambles that they were against Newcastle, I thought they'd be there for the take. And Everton just completely wiped the floor over Leeds. It's difficult. It's really difficult to explain that team at the minute. And yeah, so it's a bit guttering that they're a little bit away from the relegation zone with them. But yeah, hopefully they get sucked into it.
Yeah, that Everton one, that took me by surprise, to be honest. I thought Everton would be really under pressure in that game, but seemingly not. Brentford, another one that, well, Cossi, you've alluded to them ever since I've known you on this podcast, to be on this podcast. You've got nothing but great things to say about Brentford. 2 games, 2-0 defeat to City, which you probably wouldn't, you know, there's no surprises in that one. And a 0-0 draw against Palace. Now, obviously, they've been on the periphery. I've said for a few weeks that Thomas Frank seems like the pressure's getting to him a little bit with his post-match analysis. Seems to be going a bit crazy in some of them. So 14th, 24 points, 7 away from Norwich. They've probably just about got enough. I mean, obviously it's early days and there's still a cluster of teams to play each other down there.
The head-to-heads for Brentford will be huge.
Massive, massive.
Because, like I said, I don't like Slayton Brentford. However, it did piss me off how their little honeymoon of like, oh, little old Brentford coached the Premier League. Oh, they did really well, didn't they? And then all of a sudden, they're getting battered by Norwich at home. They're getting battered by so many other teams. And you think, well, hang on a minute. They are slowly moving down that table. And that they should be looking over their shoulders, because I think a lot of other fans, I know I said it very prematurely. However, my premature prediction is starting to look into shape. They might have already done enough, and they could get a lucky 1-2-0, 2-1 or whatever win with their 24 points. However, with the teams they've got to play around them, that could start to think, well, hang on a minute. We could get into the bottom three here, because there's a lot of teams around them who are now playing a lot better than they are.
Come April, I think you'll know how close Brentford are, because they've got Arsenal next. Obviously, you know, we're expecting that to go one way, even though they beat the first game of the season.
Brentford win against the small team.
But then they've got Newcastle, Norwich and Burnley. Now, I'd probably say if they get a win against one of those teams, I think they're safe.
Agreed.
However, if they don't pick up a win, they need 3 points out of those three games somehow or another, because that will just give them enough to get themselves a point ahead of those teams. But if they don't pick up any points against those three teams, I think they could be really close, because, you know, when you look at the fact that they are 4 games ahead of Burnley, you know, Norwich win their next game to go level on games with Brentford. They're only 4 points behind them. And especially if Norwich picked up a draw or a win. I mean, if Norwich beat Brentford, for example, it's looking dangerous. I can't see Brentford getting 19-20. It's going to be 18th. That's the spot. And at the moment, Norwich occupy it. So, yeah, it's going to be a big march for Brentford. Looking at that.
One thing I will say on Brentford, watching it, the Palace game, and looking at it from a Brentford perspective, because we've spoken about Palace already. The one thing that would concern me about Brentford in that game is obviously that was a home game. And they never really, I mean, Palace dominated possession, and it was well documented how Palace's lack of cut and edge probably saved Brentford a little bit, to be honest. But from a Brentford perspective, I know they didn't have Tony in the starting 11 because he was out with a thigh injury or whatever it was, but they really didn't, really, apart from the debated VAR call, which probably should have been a penalty, they didn't really create much, and they didn't really get at Palace, you know. And we see Brentford on the TV, these live games giving teams a go. There was never really any of that given a go. So I'd be... against a kind of, I wouldn't say out of sorts Palace because they're good on their day, but against an inconsistent Palace, I'd be disappointed if I was a Brentford fan, and just a little bit concerned that they didn't really lay a glove. Because as you said, and you just read that fixture list there, with those kind of key head-to-heads still to come up, they can't just sit back in those games like they did against Palace and kind of scrape by with a point here or there. You know, they've got to turn one of those... Ironically, I say this about Palace as well, but they've got to turn one or two of those draws into a win just to break themselves away. But there was nothing to suggest on Saturday against Palace that they had the confidence to do that. And you seemingly, I mean, the manager seems pretty bullish, but quite arrogantly bullish at the moment. But in his head, he needs to stay calm, because, you know, I'm not being funny, as I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, these kind of little outbursts where he's saying, oh, we played well, we were fantastic, but we just didn't get the result, can only get you so far and doesn't necessarily draw confidence from the rest of the players. So, interesting one. I don't think ultimately they'll go down, but, you know, stranger things have happened, and I'll roll on to Norwich now, seemingly. A point midweek against Palace, and they had a very good opening, well, very good first half. That was a true gain of two halves, that game. Very, very good game against Palace. Could have been out of sight by half time, to be honest. Could have been two, maybe even three, had they been able to be a little bit more clinical. And I'll be honest, obviously a lot of people will say, oh, there's no surprise they lost 4-0 to City. And hindsight's a wonderful thing, and we can say all we want, ooh, little individual mistake here and there, that shouldn't have happened, this shouldn't have happened. Norwich were really, really unlucky, I think. I think 4-0 flat at City, and...
big time.
You know, a couple of those, you know, I think it was the second goal, I remember thinking, oh, no, that's such a bad mistake to make. Little areas like that. Now, obviously, it's, you know, smaller clubs like Palace's and Norwich, you'd expect that, and that's why City end up ultimately winning the games the way they do. But tell you what, if I was an Norwich fan and looking at that game, I'd be very optimistic, despite it being 4-0, because they gave City a good go and they weren't afraid. And
first half we looked up for the battle, to be honest. I think everyone in the stadium knew what to expect, to be honest. We were never going to get a win. However, if we, like, you know, puff our chests out, try and play half decent football, keep them out, etc., etc., we hit the woodwork. And if that had gone in, we could have put a bit of pressure on the City. It was men versus robots, really, because City was just such a well-oiled machine, and it was a pleasure watching them. To be honest, they were a very, very, very insanely good side. But again, levels, we're not gonna take anything other than positive from the game. If we would have scored, then City would have really had to have thought, well, do you know what? We have to get out of second gear here. But fair play to Sterling, brilliant performance. I think he was my end when he missed the penalty but scored the rebound. And fans, as always, were giving him dog's abuse, as most players do anyway. But he didn't react to any of it. He just got on with his game, and, you know, like a separate issue when it comes to the press. But I've got a huge, huge respect and a lot of time for Sterling. And yeah, again, it was a pleasure watching a great English talent, to be honest. But not much you can say other than 0 points for the next two games. Obviously, Man City being the first one, Liverpool being the second one. But as long as we don't embarrass ourselves, as long as we can take some positives from it and not beat ourselves up over it, which I don't think we'll do, especially under Dean Smith, it's to be expected. And yeah, we move on.
Thoughts on the Palace game? A little bit gutted?
Yeah, first half, like I said, we should have been. If Pookie would have taken his chances 2-0, I think that would have, that really would have not necessarily put the game to bed. However, we've seen what Norwich can do under Dean Smith. Hold on to a lead, become a little bit more shithousery, take our time with things and get into Palace's faces. However, it wasn't to be. I was gutted. However, overall, first half we had the better play. Second half you had the better play, and overall we are lucky that we didn't come away with 0 points simply because of the penalty miss. However, it could have been dead and buried by half time, and I'm gutted it wasn't. But it's another point and another good performance overall. But yeah, it's gutted. We've got to take our chances in the Championship. We'd have had 3 or 4 more chances and won that 3-0 by half time. You never know, but. Yeah, I can't really say much other than a little bit disappointed, a little bit gutted. But overall, a draw was a fair result, being a massive realist that I like to be.
And the big question, what's your gut feeling? Enough in the tank to get over the line? See, obviously Newcastle make that difficult now, given their results, but...
I don't think so, personally, still. However, I'm the most excited I've ever been for the battle, because now we're actually puffing our shoulders up and, like, you know, puffing our chests out and looking good. You know, it's not as pretty as under Farc, but we're also not complete bottle jobs like we were under Farc. And we're not showing teams too much respect when they come to Carrow Road now. And the atmosphere is a little bit more hostile. The support for the team is a lot more positive. We can see what we're trying to do, and again, we're just being realistic with what we can do. Smith is doing what he can do with the players that we've got, and yeah, we're going to give it a go. We're up for the fight now, and like I said, having that bit of fight about us, that's all that us fans want to see.
Yeah, no, I mean, to be honest, it surprised me with Dean Smith. He came in, I'd say, for right manager, right time, but for obviously the wrong reasons, focusing on just doing what they can, and then obviously, but he has surprised me, and they are going for it. So now I'm not going to mull too much over the next couple here. I think it's fair to say between the three of us, we wouldn't say there were too many surprises. So I'll go on to Man City. We've just spoken about the Brentford game. Fairly comfortable 2-0 win, to be honest. Well-oiled machine. And, you know, we've just spoken about the Norwich game there again.
Probably similar, like I said, probably similar to the Norwich game. They didn't necessarily really have to do too much because the opposition wasn't really showing too much to put them under threat. I only know from a perspective of a Norwich fan that we hit the post. If that had gone in, Man City would have had to have gone through the gears and perhaps, you know, they would have ended up battering us probably overall anyway. Probably a similar situation to Brentford. They didn't really show too much, didn't really have to get out of second gear, did what they had to do. Well-oiled machine, robots versus men. Easy win.
One thing that surprised me, well, not surprised me, that's probably wrong, but I don't know if you called it, I only saw it this morning, to be honest, and Pep Guardiola was asked the magic question. We always debate, if he doesn't win the Champions League, is he going to be a failure? Is he, you know, is he wrong to focus on the league and so forth? And when asked that question this past weekend, his response was, the Premier League is the most important. Is he correct? And if they don't win the Champions League, in all honesty, from a footballing, a purely footballing perspective, when you consider the achievements of Liverpool in recent years, when you consider the achievements of, I can't believe I'm even saying this, but when you consider the achievements of Manchester United, when they won trophies and titles, where does, when you take Liverpool and United in isolation, where does that leave Pep's legacy if they don't win the Champions League?
Reason it's the most important one to Pep is because it's the only one that he knows he can win. So he's not going to say anything that he can't back up. He knows he can't win that Champions League 100%. He knows he can win the league 100%. Give him two attempts at the league, he'll win it once. Give him five attempts at the Champions League and he's not confident he wins any of them. Let's just put it this way. If he wins a Champions League, he gets a statue. If he don't win a Champions League, he ain't getting one. Pellegrini didn't get one. Mancini didn't get one. He ain't getting one. He'll be remembered as a legend. Don't get me wrong. But they won't name a stand after him and call it the Guardiola stand because he's been brought in. Look, at the end of the day, he can win as many domestic titles as he wants. But if you ask the board in 20 years' time, what was Pep Guardiola brought in for that Mancini and Pellegrini and all of them didn't do, was to win a Champions League trophy. They did not pay all this money out to have him win what they were already winning anyway. You're telling me if Mancini was still there, he wouldn't be having City at the top, maybe?
Spot on with that.
I think as good as he is, and I'm not going to sit here and go, because he's never won the Champions League like Tuchel or Klopp, he's not in that bracket. In my opinion, he's a better manager than Tuchel. It's just the way it panned out. He has got a sense of arrogance in the way that he sets up in games, hence the Champions League downfall, which is his own undoing. If he can sort that out, then yes, I do think he's... I mean, his squad, the problem that Guardiola's got, if I asked you boys, bearing in mind you put the question to us, Chase, has Guardiola had a squad in the past 5 years even that have been capable to win the Champions League?
Yes, 100%.
So, well, there it is.
100%. It's that one game, isn't it? It's that one game that Guardiola just struggles with, isn't it? If you go to Anfield, if you go to a lot of other, like, or even Spurs can be included in that, obviously, because when you knocked him out, it's one of those, that one game, have they got that fight? Have they got that, well, you know, as cringeworthy as it says, have they got that 12th man? They don't need that when it comes to the Premier League because they're so well oiled, so well drilled. They know that they can control games. But when it comes to that one fighting Champions League game, they're beatable.
The thing that baffled me about City and this elusive Champions League is when they got to the final, he took a massive gamble and played Foden and Gundogan as the centre mid, didn't he? So there was no shield in the midfield. Backfired miserably. And he didn't play a striker, if I remember rightly. He didn't start with a striker on the pitch either. So, number one, naivety on his part there cost them that game, I think. But two, despite the issues in that Champions League final, one of them being the midfield balance and the second one being lack of an attacking threat, do you not find it strange that, I mean, as Cossie says, look, and as you've said, Scott, it's very easy to, for him to win the Premier League. I mean, there's no easy games, but they're a well-drilled machine. They'll beat most teams very, very comfortably. They'll come unstuck against the odd one or two where they get caught off guard for having an off day, but they can afford to not have a striker. Now, for me, if the Holy Grail at Man City is the Champions League, we're sitting here now, and in the summer, their marquee headline signing, despite the rumours about Haaland, despite the rumours about various other attacking options, their £100 million signing was not a striker. And for me, I don't know about you boys, but for me, the one thing they are missing in order to win that Champions League this season is an Aguero or a striker.
If they had signed Vlahovic or someone like that, it's game over. It is game over. However, I'm still sitting here now, and with Man City, when you're as dominant as Man City, you think of all the dominant sides that you've had over the past 20 years. Did anyone want to be drawn against Barcelona? No. Did anyone want to be drawn against Real Madrid during that stint? No. Did you even want to face Chelsea when it was Pete Mourinho and all? No. Do you want to face Klopp in a champion? No. If you come out against City, though, do you not think you can catch them on a bad day? I mean, it's been proven, has it? Like, we Spurs undone City in the Champions League. We've undone them multiple times, in fact. I would much rather... How can you have a team so dominant fifth in my list of teams? I mean, I would rather pay. I would rather face Man City than Bayern Munich's. If you had Bayern Munich had five injuries and a bench, I'd still rather face Man City. So I think that's your answer.
Yeah, I just thought it was really interesting. And it seems to be the one thing that is eluding him at the moment. So anyway, moving on. So the last couple of games, again, no real surprises, or maybe a little bit of a surprise about how lackluster it was, but given that Mane and Salah had just arrived. But Liverpool, 2-0 win at Anfield over Leicester. We mentioned Leicester earlier, very disappointing from them. They didn't really give anything Liverpool to think about in that regard. Liverpool just went through the motions, I think, as they could with the squad they've got available to them. And Burnley, I mean, Burnley's always a tough place to go, given that Salah and Mane had just come back from AFCON. You know, they did what they needed to do, scraped a 1-0 win, two clean sheets and 6 points. Probably not enough to catch City in the Premier League, but they keep doing what they're doing in order to get second.
It's going to make it, just to make it interesting, really, isn't it? If City get a couple of draws, if Liverpool win the head-to-head, then the title race could be open again.
What about the fact that Diogo Jota's is the number one for headed goals this season?
How tall is he? 5'8", 5'9"?
I must admit, I was one of those when Liverpool signed him. I was like, 30 million, bit left field, because he was good for Wolves, but he wasn't the star man. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, 30 million, that's a Liverpool squad player signing that'll be at Palace in 3 or 4 years.
40, time. Wasn't it?
You know, he has really stepped up. And as you say, his intelligence, I mean, granted, he misses some sitters, but for such a short guy to get on the end of crosses like that and squeeze in to get headers and, you know, amazing. But again, Klopp obviously saw something in him to fit the system that Liverpool needed. And by God, did he get it right, because it's definitely worked out for them. Just a quick one on Chelsea. Club World Cup winners. I mean, what does that even mean? It's, you know, glorified. I mean, no disrespect to the South American teams, because it's a big deal for them. But let's be honest. I mean,
I saw a really interesting debate the other day about this. And it's interesting you've come out guns blazing saying that, because there was an argument put that there is no more important trophy than that one, because no club can win it without winning the Champions League. And even that, in the past 20 years, only three English clubs have ever won it. And they say, because it's so exclusive, I mean, I can't remember who, Jamie O'Hara, I think, I mean, Jamie, what did Jamie O'Hara know? Absolute numpty.
The guy's a joke.
he turned round and said he'd much rather win a Carabao Cup or whatever than that. But there was someone that argued and said, because of how prestigious it is, yes, the tournament in itself is a joke, but the manner in which what you have to go through to get there and what you have to do to get there, is there a more difficult competition to win? Because you have to win the Champions League to do it.
When you put it like that, I can't see how anyone can disagree with that.
Yeah.
But when big teams fans are talking about it, they always play it down unless you've won it or unless you've been there. Whereas when you put it into context, like, you know, Arsenal fans might turn around and say, what's the point? Man City fans, etc. It's like, well, at the end of the day, like you said, the fact of what everything you have to go through to actually get there in the first place and then to win it, you know, it's not for everyone.
Some of the South American teams aren't actually, you know, they're pretty good. I think Palmeiras was in there. I don't know if that's the one that Chelsea had to beat. I didn't follow it too often, I have to admit. But, you know, as you say, when you put it on paper like that, you can only get there if you win the Champions League. I mean, to win the Champions League in itself is massive. And I guess it's one... No, I mean, we had the debate about AFCON, didn't we? And, you know, the debate came up about AFCON and should that... when you look at it like that, of course, the continents of South America and Asia, they should most definitely be respected. So in that regard, it's a trophy, it's a competition in its own right. So
you also have to remember that once Liverpool got to the final, lost to Sao Paulo, and Chelsea have only won it for their first time this year, because the last time they got there, they lost to Corinthians in the final. It was an interesting pitch, to be honest, and it's certainly one that I would love to know that, you know, if Guardiola could turn around and say, you know, would he like to have that with Man City? I don't think he'd turn it down, would he?
No. And I'll be honest, I've never actually taken the time to watch a Club World Championship final. So I don't, even though on paper, most football fans would be like, oh, it's pointless as a pre-season trophy. But actually, it's not, because it's the best in South America and the rest of the club continents versus the best of Europe, isn't it? So in that regard, it's, you know, and look, we've all watched River Plate and Boca Juniors, and we've seen how good the, you know, the South American teams are, and, you know, Flamengo, Sao Paulo's, they're all up there in their own right. So, and in their own context of domestic success. Well, I must say I've had an absolute nightmare here, because we'd normally say we'll save the best till last, and Brighton are the last game to cover. So I've not really done a good job in ordering the, you know, I've put the shit last, but anyway. And probably actually one of the most pointless games last, because, again, Brighton-Watford. I mean, Watford turn up. We mentioned Watford earlier on. Pretty comfortable for Brighton. Malpay again.
I mean,
good goal.
It's not pointless in regards to, you know, me costing Cookie, because, it's just further enhancing that, you know, we've got a free meal coming. So, you know, I think you've saved the best till last, really, because is it 7 points and Brighton have got a game in hand?
Two or three games, lads. Two or three games. All good. It's all good.
Yeah, but Palace have got to win a game, though.
Very funny.
I've already got my order in my head.
We're going to go when there's eat out to help out discount on.
I mean, to be fair, you could throw a KFC out there, Jason. I don't think Cossie and me will complain, to be honest.
Mate, that's one of the, yeah, Valentine's Day bucket, finger looking good. I'm all over it.
I'm going to check my Groupon coupons come the end of the season. But no, look, Mopay again, annoyingly. Interesting, I think Jermaine Jean has mentioned this on Match of the Day. He's one of them, frustratingly, where he's not going to get you 15 to 20 goals and he's not going to score the simple chances he's meant to put away. You see him actually most of the time try and put away those simple chances and he never seems to do it. But give him a spectacular goal and he'll put one away for you.
He's a scorer of good goals, not a good goal scorer. And I do like that at the same time, though.
This is his purple patch, though, this year. He's got what he got last year in nearly what? Just over half the games. So this is his first peak season, to be honest. You know, 21 games, 8 goals last season, 33 games, 8 goals. So it looks like he's finally hit some kind of form. But yeah, you're right. Never looks like a player that will ever get to 15, 20 goals a season. But then again, who's to say he might not get 15? Because there's only three players this season that are in double figures at this moment in time. So still might be onto something. Never know.
Well, let's hope not for the sake of my wallet, but we'll see. We'll see. Well, that wraps up the double game weeks and all the games. A lot of interesting chat and debate there, lads. Not going to lie, that was there's a lot to cover off from that. So we've done pretty well there. And well, I guess the final thing to cover off is our predictions for the coming game week. So a bit of an anomaly talking of...
Brighton.
Sorry, oh God. Sorry, Seagull Simon. I don't know what happened there. It must have been a sound error. There's a game week 18 game penciled in for tomorrow night at Old Trafford. So Brighton United, 8:15 kickoff. So for the purpose of this, we won't be covering that in the predictions. We're going to head straight into game week 26, a full calendar of fixtures. So game week 26 then, lads.
I've already got Cookie's game, if that helps.
Yeah, let's kick off with Cookie.
Get that one out of the way. He's gone for the rivalry, not a derby, as Jason would say. He's gone for Leeds Man United.
Ooh, tasty. I'm going to say 3-2 Leeds.
Okay, Cookie's gone 2-2, just to give you a heads up.
I was going to go 1-1 then. Literally before you said that, I was thinking 1-1 because I can't see Man United score more than one.
You're always very conservative. I feel like you sit on the fence a lot.
Oh yeah, very, very much sit on the fence, apart from whenever any team is facing Brentford.
I'm going to say this might be one that, you know, Man United always get one every now and again. I think it could be this one. I'm going to say 1-0. Nothing exciting, because let's be honest, it never happens. So yeah, 1-0 Man United on mine. I've gone West Ham Newcastle for my game, and I've said 2-2 in this one.
I'm going to say 1-1.
2-2. Is that what you went for as well?
Yeah.
What did Cookie go for?
He went 2-1 West Ham.
Cossy, what's your pick?
Yeah, I'm going to go for the Wolves Leicester game. Ooh. And I'm going to go 1-0 Wolves.
Classic.
Not even backing Leicester for the goal, really, there.
Nah, Leicester are shit. I'm joking, Leicester fans.
Funny enough, Cookie's just also gone 1-0 Wolves.
Although I should say what Crossy said, because he seems to get everything fucking correct. In fact, I think going forward, I should just say everything that Crossy says, and I'll just match points with him. But I'm going to go and pull a rabbit out of the hat, and I'm going to say 2-1 Leicester, because if they don't win that, I can see Rodgers being out of the job very, very quickly.
I'm going to say 2-1 Wolves.
Final game, I'm going to go for the air of unpredictability like the rest of the games. I am going to go for Southampton Everton. And I am going to say 3-1 Southampton.
That's what I had in my head. I'm going to stick with my gut on that one, mate, and join you on that.
2-1 Southampton.
Oh, look, another point in his bag.
Well, Cookie's gone 2-1 Southampton then, like Cossy, so that's done. Right, that's the predictions done, boys. One thing we haven't done for a while, and look at your faces, you know what I'm alluding to as well. We haven't done a who's up or down for quite some time, have we?
Oh my God, this is so outdated now, isn't it?
Let's give each other three positions to move.
Oh my Christ, where do I don't even know what my table is anymore.
I've got it in front of me now.
Just to help, I'm going to move Liverpool up to second because I had Chelsea in second.
I've got exactly the same as well.
And I'm going to move Leicester down two spots because they were currently, for some reason, that goes to show how long ago this was, they were in sixth for me.
Yeah, I've got them in sixth as well. I've still got Southampton in like 18th or 17th.
I've got Watford in 16th.
Better adjust it then, boys. Off you go.
I'm just going to put up three places. So 1, 2, 3, 14. There you go.
I'm going to put Watford down two places, and I've done exactly what Scott did and put Liverpool to second and Chelsea to third.
Yeah, maybe need to get back on that one just to bring that to life because now you've got to rescue your table. So that'll be interesting. All good, Jace. Over to you, mate.
On that note, fellas, it's been an absolute pleasure, but this love triangle has to exit and make a swift swan song away. So have yourselves a good evening. Thanks again for joining us. And until next week, we'll be back as a quartet. See you then.
Bye-bye, driver.